For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
The unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000,000,000 kalpas. Now I can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May I unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. For new people, I'm excited to be here, and I'm very happy to have given a talk this morning. Nyozanarag Shuk, who is one of our practice leaders and is the leader of our affiliate group down in Hyde Park at Rockefeller Chapel for these Wednesday afternoons. Nyozan, thank you very much for giving your talk.
Thanks, Taigen. Good morning, everybody. Today I'm going to talk about perfection and imperfection. Keep a close eye. You may be see me demonstrate one or both of those. And some of you have heard me maybe talk about some of this stuff before, and if I'm repeating myself, I apologize, but I've been thinking about it a lot. Last night, I had visitors. Three people came to my house. They were people in the Zen Peacemakers Order, and they were on their way to Pine Ridge, the Lakota Reservation at Pine Ridge, to spend some time there. And they got to my place very wet at about 8 o'clock last night, and they were gone by 5 this morning. And in between, it was very nice. As could others hear, with my trained and discerning eye, it was very obvious that these were Zen students. It was absolutely no problem to have them sort of slide in and out of my place. I'm sure that many people here would recognize that, people who've had this kind of polishing, this kind of training. At the same time, there was like zero, for somebody who had not spent time with Zen people, they would not have noticed it necessarily. They would think, oh, those are nice folks. But they would have not noticed it, or they would have thought, what's with these guys? So there was like no, it was completely non-stink, right? They weren't presenting themselves in very obvious ways as Zen students. They were just being Zen students. And so I'm going to come back to them in a little bit. It was very interesting. It was very nice. And two of them are Bernie Glassman's main caretakers now that he's had a stroke, or there have been until recently. And he apparently is doing well, and he likes your Dongshan book. Suzuki Roshi said a lot of things. One of the things he said was you are something along the lines of you're perfect as you are and you could use some work. And I'm looking for somebody who's chuckling. David's chuckling. Why is that funny? If you don't mind me asking.
It's the contradictions, both are true.
Yeah, they're both true, or they can't both be. Well, yeah, they're a paradox, right? I think that they're both true, but it's very hard to sort of parse in our minds how they could both be true together. You know, it seems to be one or the other. Yogi Berra said a similar thing, if the world were perfect, it wouldn't be. And there's this kind of weird way in which these kinds of statements kind of twist themselves inside out, and, you know, it, in a way that kind of doesn't make any sense, that, you know, both of them sort of like tie into, you know, make, link perfection and imperfection in this way, that if you accept the statements on their own terms, you'll never be able to make one of them go away. They need each other. And that's kind of what the heart of my talk is going to be. I want to say that that in our, you know, sort of, if you sort of parse those statements out in symbolic logic, you're never going to get them to line up. They can't both be true at the same time. But, you know, I would like to say this is a true paradox in the sense that it's apparently not true, can't be, but nonetheless is. And the place in which the truth of that way of putting it forward is never going to be here. It's never going to be intellectually. It just will not work. And so so the best thing, the best response, I think, is maybe David's and others, is to laugh when we hear that. It's funny. Nonetheless, I think that they are, that it is a paradox in the sense that even though they can't seem to work together, they are in fact, taken in their totality, true. And the place in which we find that that's true is in Zazen. So Suzuki Roshi's statement, I think, winds up being a kind of a Zazen instruction. Not only do we, is it possible for us to make this sort of reconciliation, if we want to put it that way, in our Zazen, I think it's in some sense of the utmost importance that we do resolve that. And in part, it's because we've had lessons about what happens when people hang on to "you are perfect as you are" and let go of "you could use some work," or if taking the other side, they hang on to "you could use some work" and lose sight of the other side of it. I think that means there's a sort of a necessary tension, if we can use that word, in our practice, and that it's good and that it's needed, and that if we let go of either side of this, there could be serious problems in our practice, or it just might go slack and kind of limp and not manifest for us in the way that we wish that it would. For a lot of us, this idea of "you are perfect is just as you are" is barely even, we can barely even make that compute. But it's not hard to see that people do, and that that could lead to problems. And I'm going to sort of rely on two koans. I'm going to read you parts of koans, not even the whole thing, to sort of demonstrate, I think, two sides of these. I mean, each side of this, like what happens when you let one go. And I'd like to sort of make a proviso here. Sigmund Freud, if anybody read his really early book, The Interpretation of Dreams, he talks about the manifest content of dreams, the stuff that's kind of on the surface, easy to see, and then the latent content, which is the real, that's the interpretive work. You dig into that and find out what's really going on in those dreams. Well, using that sort of image, I'm going to look at the manifest content of two koans and leave the interpretation of the latent content to others for another day. But the first one, Bai Zhang and the Fox, very famous koan, and I'm just going to read you the first half of it. There's a second half, but it's not relevant to my purposes right now. Okay. When Master Bai Zhang Huai Hai taught, an old man would always come to hear his Dharma talk. He always left when the assembly did, but one day he didn't leave. Bai Zhang asked, "Who is it that stands there?" The old man said, "I am not a human being. I was the abbot of this monastery at the time of Kashyapa Buddha." Interesting there. He was the abbot of the monastery. He himself was Bai Zhang. I was abbot of this monastery at the time of Kashyapa Buddha. A student asked me, "Does an enlightened person fall into cause and effect?" I said to him, "No, such a person does not." Because I said this, I became a wild fox for 500 lifetimes. Reverend Master, please say a turning word for me. Free me from this wild fox body. Then he asked Bai Zhang, "Does an enlightened person fall into cause and effect?" Bai Zhang said, "Don't ignore cause and effect." Immediately, the old man was greatly enlightened. He bowed and said, "I am now liberated from the body of the wild fox. My fox body will be found on the other side of the mountain. Master, please do me a favor and bury it as you would a deceased monastic." So the koan goes on, but this is the part that's relevant to what I want to say today. Bai Zhang's problem, at least the Bai Zhang who presents himself in the body of an old man and in the body of a fox, was denying cause and effect, you know, not seeing that cause and effect was, in other words, karma, how we actually go about our business in the daily world was concern to somebody who had supposedly woken up, freed themselves from karma. And consequently, by this denial, ironically you could say, or necessarily, winds up chained to what? Further rebirth, chained to further living out of karma. And not only that, but in a way that whatever else foxes may be in the lore, they're not human. Somehow this person, by refusing the burden of karma, both stayed trapped to it, and somehow thereby impinged upon or damaged inhibited the full expression of his human nature, and because of inhibiting his full expression of his human nature was inhibiting the expression of Buddha nature too. In other words, waking up is not enough. That's just the start. We've seen the problems that we, you know, there's been this really sorry sort of parade of Zen teachers in particular, and others as well, who, you know, and we see it much more widely, of people who start with this, you know, "I'm awake, I'm a hoity-toity Zen guy, therefore, you know, if I do this or if I do that, it might be okay." You know, these sort of karmic conditions no longer apply to me. So that's the really pernicious side. The more negative, you know, or the other negative side is maybe just a kind of slackness or laziness that could result. And this was obviously, concern to Dogen in terms of the question that Dogen, so for those of you who don't know, is the founder in Japan of our line of teaching. You know, supposedly that's kind of the question that got him going to China, or it's related to it. You know, if we have Buddha nature, if we have original enlightenment, why do we need to practice? It was concern to him too when he got these students from the Daruma school. You know, and the rap on them supposedly was, you know, this sort of over adherence to the side of Buddha nature and perfection, to the neglect of precepts and cause and effect, karma, if we want to put it in that language. So I think that koan is a warning about that. Suzuki Roshi talks about practicing without gaining idea. There seems to be some kind of a consensus that part of what this implies is all the kinds of things we hear about Zazen is not self-help, Buddhism isn't about becoming a better person, it isn't about cause and effect, it isn't about needing work, it's about coming to let your inherent nature express itself. There's a lot of that. What gets lost in that sort of read of Suzuki Roshi is that the book that comes from, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, is also absolutely chock full of comments about, you know, learning how to bake your life like you bake a loaf of bread, learning how to improve your character. You know, there's language of improvement, development, equally there. So, and I think that this is perfectly in keeping with his "you could use some work" side of things, that sort of insisting on the truth of that. So let's look at the other side of it. I'm going to talk about the polishing a tile koan, read a bit of that. Nanyue polishes a brick. How am I doing for time? I can't. Okay. Zen master Matsu Daoyi was an attendant to Nanyue and personally received the mind seal from him, exceeding his peers. Before that, he lived in Kaiyuan Monastery and did Zazen all day long. Knowing that Matsu was a Dharma vessel, Nanyue went to him and asked, "Great monastic, what do you intend by doing Zazen?" Matsu said, "I'm intending to be a Buddha." Nanyue picked up a brick and started polishing it. Matsu said, "What are you doing?" Nanyue said, "I'm trying to make a mirror." Matsu said, "How can you make a mirror by polishing a brick?" Nanyue said, "How can you become a Buddha by doing Zazen?" Matsu said, "What do you mean by that?" Nanyue said, "Think about driving a cart. When it stops moving, do you whip the cart or the horse?" Matsu said nothing. Nanyue said, Do you want to practice sitting Zen or sitting Buddha? If you understand sitting Zen, you will know that Zen is not about sitting or lying down. If you want to learn sitting Buddha, know that sitting Buddha is without any fixed form. Do not use discrimination in the non-abiding Dharma. If you practice sitting as Buddha, you must kill Buddha. If you are attached to the sitting form, you're not yet mastering the essential principle. Matsu heard this admonition and felt as if he had tasted sweet nectar. So there we have the other side. We've got a guy who thinks he's going to make himself into a Buddha. How's he going to make himself into a Buddha? By doing a lot of Zazen. He could use some work. He could use so much work that he's going to develop himself wholeheartedly to perfecting himself by doing all that work. But by, as his teacher points out, by making that move, you know, he's set it up so not only that has he lost sight of the fact that he already has that nature. He doesn't have to produce it. He doesn't have to work at it in quite that sense. And in fact, by setting it up that way, it can't be achieved. It's always by one's own activity set elsewhere, set beyond. And so this touches on the other side. Now, you know, interestingly, the way the point is made is this guy picks up a brick and starts polishing it. Says he wants to make a mirror. It's not like he's doing something really crazy. It's not like he's hopping on one foot and saying, you know, if I hop on one foot, I'm going to learn how to fly, or anything like that. He's polishing a brick. And polishing a brick, as Suzuki Roshi points out, in one of his essays somewhere, is you polish a brick to make a beautiful tile. I mean, you polish the tile to make a beautiful tile. You're not making a mirror. You're not making a Buddha. You are doing, you know, what is appropriate with that element of your life. And so the notion there seems to be not, as some have taken it historically, taking things like this and taking things like the Platform Sutra, it's not that that Matsu is in any way mistaken about doing Zazen. Of course you do Zazen. But he's really confused about the nature of doing it. And he's doing it in such a way that he's creating a problem for himself in practice that gets undone in this story. In other words, you know, whereas in the first story we could say that Baizhang lost sight of the you could use some work kind of thing. In this other story, Matsu loses the sight of, yeah, you're going to be doing that work, but you already have that nature. Can't help it. And so I think that these kind of, as I said, they in our practice, they sort of need each other. You know, without it, we can either not come up with the kind of faith in ourselves and in our peers and Sangha and our teachers and so on that we need to carry us through the practice without believing, yes, that good, solid, perfect thing is available and it's here. On the other hand, if we just go with that and think, okay, given that, it doesn't matter what I do, that would equally be a mistake and equally harmful. So just, you know, come back. I mean, I don't know if it ties together anything coherently or not, but to return to these visitors that I had in this context, it's like, as I said, there was no... nobody's putting on any kind of like I'm a good Zen student kind of thing, not at all. But they were, and so it was clear that you know this kind of, you know, I like the image of polishing a tile. Sometimes we talk about practice as a kind of polishing, and it was clear that these people had done a lot of that kind of work. Why, you know? Maybe not to become Buddhas, but it made them damn good house guests. You know, really nice to be around. And so I think we can say while you know, practice is not about self-help. It's not about becoming a better person. It's not this or that. It's also not those things. That's involved. And we can say that, you know, even though we have a lot of work to do, both if we want to be a good house guest or if we want to fully express ourselves, sit on our cushions as Buddhas, you know, it's clear that we've got a lot of work to do. But it's not that... So it's not about resting in our perfection. But it's also not about resting in our perfection. We really, somehow, even though it makes no sense, we've got to have both of those in our practice. Or we're liable to kind of go, we're going to miss the middle way. We're going to miss this non-abidable place and settle down somewhere in a way that we maybe don't want to. So that's pretty loose, but I hope I've made the point. And I apologize to everybody who's ever like tried to handle koans responsibly for doing such a kind of job on them. But I'd appreciate it if anybody's got any comments or questions. Asian? Precisely.
Not real, but maintenance. You know, we have to continue to bring things, to bring different aspects of our lives, or bring things to life, or you know, just bring a practice to a new situation.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Thank you. I mean that's really exactly what this talk is about. It's about practice realization. Those two things not being in any straightforward causal. You know, punch button A, you get button, you know, effect B.
Yeah, otherwise it's just dead.
Yeah. So thank you. What?
You can't see it. Something
is rolling across the floor. It's the tip of the microphone. So I thought the talk was just about perfect, but obviously.
until I screwed it up, by.
comments, Andy.
Thanks for the talk. I think you said that there's an apparent paradox in that statement. I don't know. I think that perhaps, but I think. It's an expression of one is true that we're perfect just as we are, we're already Buddha. Is true in the absolute sense. And then we need some work that's true in the relative sense. And I think this is the thing that seems to a lot. We have no abiding self, absolutely, but we experience that self every day. And all forms are empty, and everything is kind of just this perhaps undifferentiated cloud of atoms or whatever.
to say go, but there's also the other side. So it's maybe, and I know I had the feeling that without saying that so directly, that was what you were planning.
Well, if I understand you, yeah, something like that. I mean, there's this idea, and it's precisely this idea of thinking of states, you know, and we think about, you know, states of perfection. We think about, you know, being enlightened rather than, you know, this processual thing of waking up. And so it becomes, so there's a danger of like we see perfection, whatever word we want to put into that slot, as this finished thing, and lose sight of the fact that actually it's not, it can't actually be a state. It's like this dynamic process, and dynamic process is always involves it sort of loads it to say imperfection, but Suzuki Roshi in the book, he talks about, you know, beauty as being sort of imbalance taking place against a background of balance, that kind of thing. Or we're talking about suffering, dukkha, as being the way we actually extend our lives. It gets very dangerous to, be taken as a dangerous justification for all kinds of bad things. So I want to be a little careful about it. But you know, we agree. So this might just seem like a trite argument, but I think there's importance to it, that Buddhist practice is a good thing. Well, why do you practice? You practice because, you know, we're not perfect. Our lives aren't perfect. You know, they're tense. They're screwed up. We have issues. It seems kind of backwards, but if we want to say, okay, but we know that practice is a good thing, then in some way we also have to say, and, you know, thank God I have the opportunity by being, you know, human being, whatever.
Thank you. Yeah, just to follow up on that, to add to that, I appreciate you bringing up that dynamic of the state or the realm and then the process. And I think of perfection as a kind of process, that it is dynamic. Yeah, so these are just terms and ways of talking about stuff. But I like Dogen's statement that I talk about a lot, to just experience the vital process on the path of going beyond Buddha, as Aishin was talking about. But yeah, what you're bringing up is really important, that there's a way in which things, just as it is, how we each is, and how we all is collectively here now, it's just okay. It's what I love about Zazen, that I can feel that. And it applies in terms of all the craziness and suffering in our world, and, you know, Pine Ridge and, you know, peacemaking and so there's lots and lots of work to do, and the purpose of our doing this in some ways is to respond to the suffering of the world, and yet also we can see that just to be able to be present and breathing and be upright in our own bodies and minds, there's a kind of dignity and, you know, we might call that perfection. You know, that, or wholeness or whatever. So it's a very dynamic situation. So I appreciate you bringing up that, those terms. Yeah. And I appreciate your response. Thank you. Other responses or comments? Oh.
I'm not really sure where to go with this, but it's going to be both, this finding beauty and perfection in the way that something is being naturally experience in situations of that sometimes, or when I see something that Japanese aesthetic where this is the age of the thing, is what makes it beautiful, what makes it perfect. That's when I can sort of more of an aesthetic understanding of what sounds like those for me. Coming back to it and really situating myself with what is happening right now. It's not necessarily perfect, it's not necessarily okay, but like, for me to actually just sort of really pay attention, to really connect to what's happening right here, right now, and be able to be there ready to have a different response or a response instead of just reacting to what I think might be perfect or what I think might be perfect. All this thing is up with you because it's, you know, it's a dead thing. It's a dead to me. But you know, I only think that when I'm sitting here, things are a little bit better. Towards something while actually really saying something whatsoever right now.
There's a line from Zen My Beginner's Mind that it's in my notes and I forgot to read it or whatever, but it says, we should find perfect existence through imperfect existence. We should find perfection in imperfection. For us, complete perfection is not different from imperfection.